Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Eric Perro of ThePush.org. He is a natural builder from the United States, currently living in Portugal, developing several sustainable building projects. In this episode, we talk about the work of his organization, what it's like to learn how to do this kind of building, as well as the decision-making that's involved with bringing a group of builders and volunteers together. I think you'll find, as you listen, a certain resonance with this episode and past conversations, including those with Bob Tice, Stephen Herod-Buhner, Michael Pilarski, Jack Spierko, and the second round with Ethan Hughes. You'll find links back to these shows in the notes for this episode, as well as information on how to contact Eric and the rest of the Push.org network. If you enjoy this episode, consider making a donation to keep things going. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. While you're there, you can also find out how to follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. Now then, on to Eric Perro. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Well then, Eric, if you could give us a little bit of your background and biography, how you got to do what you're doing, and then we can take the conversation from there.
So I guess I'm not too old, but I've done quite a bit in my life already. I'm about 27, and for about a year after university, I studied business, and I got quite interested that my life was about making money, and I was a corporate consultant for a large company in the U.S., and my weekdays and weekends basically consisted of flying around the U.S., sometimes the world, and consulting with giant corporations on how they can make more money. So this was, multi-billion dollar corporations and telling them how they can make more millions. I decided that this maybe wasn't the best use of my time, and it didn't serve me. I didn't get fulfillment from it. And I never had any sort of exposure to people doing anything different than this. So I was a bit at loss of what the next step would be, although I know there needed to be a next step. So I did AmeriCorps, which is a project based in the US that basically you earn the poverty wage and provide your services to communities that have high levels of poverty to help eradicate it. And I did this work for about a year and then joined a nonprofit after that. And through that experience, I was living in Oregon, which is quite a big change from the Midwest of Indiana. And I felt finally this connection with nature. In Oregon, there's about 4 old growth forests, and I visited them all. Everyone else should too. But there's also just a lot of nature around. So sort of a long story, but basically a friend and I that I was living with had some problems with our water at the house. And we decided one night that rivers never clog. So we moved out to the woods. We found a good place. We set some tents up. We grew some vegetables. We had a glacier river running through. And we just lived off the land for about 3 months during the summer. We still had jobs at local nonprofits, but we decided that this is how we wanted to come back after our work. This experience brought in a lot of people. Some good friends decided to join, some random people who just showed up there, and it got bigger. So that winter we decided to move back to a house because we didn't know what we were doing. And the next summer we found some land on Craigslist that a beautiful family just let us into their house. They had 100 acres outside Salem. And we all moved there and we put our tents up and we had a communal kitchen place and we had goats and sheep and a llama and it was beautiful. And we had the stars every night. And this experience really solidified to me that I have a big connection with nature and this makes me happy. It's not what I originally thought. It was this money thing, absence of money, presence of money. For me, it was more this connection with nature. And so that winter when basically everyone left for grad school projects or Peace Corps or whatnot, we decided, the three of us, to build a house. And we had no idea how to build houses. And so we decided to, we knew about the Garbage Warrior documentary about the Earthships. And we bought the Earthship books and we read them a couple times. And we said, this is something that we could do. And we just dove into it. We had the Earthship books and then also Becky B's How to Make Cob. From these two books, we basically built a house in about 3 months. And through that experience, we found that so many people were coming and wanting to help and learn these skills and and saw it as a way to live, a way to be free. And it was a very powerful experience, both in our own sort of finding out how we want to live our lives, but also powerful to see that there's many other people wanting to do this as well. And these skills are not widely known. And so we had an excellent traveler by the name of Jim and his girlfriend Maria, who came, and through some conversations with them, we decided to create the push. And so this project is basically a way to help people like us who are building a house, who needed a lot of help with people who are offering to help and want to learn these skills. Because we found out that about building a sustainable house is almost the cost inverse, if you think of it like this, is almost the inverse of a traditional house. So instead of the majority of money being spent on materials with a traditional house, now the majority of money is being spent on labor. And so if we can help provide a way to bring more people to do this work, we can see more sustainable building happen on this planet.
I've interviewed the architect Bob Tice previously about doing natural building, and that the cost within the West or the global North for building a house is about 2/3 labor, 1/3 materials. You get the reverse of that when you're in the global South or elsewhere in the world. And from that conversation with Bob was that you can get friends and family to come together and help you with a project over a number of weekends, but that because a lot of the mindset of what we're used to is seeing a project advance very rapidly, what are you finding are some of the challenges of bringing people together for these kinds of projects? Or is it that the organizational management that's occurring by connecting volunteers with projects, that you don't see those same issues because of the interest and involvement of those who are coming to the sites?
At the push, we have a team of, there's six of us now, and one thing that's beautiful that we do is we're all builders. All of us do sustainable building as well. So it's not so much that we basically are sitting some sort of in a cloud managing the push organization and are fairly disconnected with what's actually happening on the ground. We have a lot of people on the project who give us amazing feedback, and we ourselves have built two, almost three houses this year. So we're busy kids. What we've experienced in our own projects is exactly what you spoke of, is this idea of time. And I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I've heard it in a few of the podcasts as well on the show, this sort of theme. And it's so relevant to sustainability, to permaculture, to this way of living in general. We are so new to this. It's unbelievable. This is such a new concept that we're still in so many ways, even though we can fully say, I want to build a sustainable house. I want to do permaculture farming. I want to have my own chickens, you know, all these things. Because we're all, most of us were born sort of in this society. We still have such a sort of hold on this idea of how quick things can happen. And what I've seen personally and what I've heard as well is that the number one blockage basically to sustainable building and sustainability is the false perception of time. One thing that we do is we have modified what we learned from the Earthship folks with their books. They do something called a bond beam, which is a way to earthquake proof the building. So it ties in the top of the walls. And you also see this with big straw bale building and earth bag building as well. And what they use in the Earthship books is rebar to go through the tires, which is metal. We said, well, man, maybe this isn't the best material. And so one thing that we use now is we just take bamboo, any sort of bamboo. We heat treat it to about 200 degrees Celsius. All the water comes out. The sugars actually caramelize and they wrap around the carbon bonds. And the bamboo actually doubles its strength. And the sugars take on a new form that bugs don't eat. So you preserve the bamboo and you double its strength. But this takes a long time. So for one house, maybe we spend 2 days heat treating the bamboo, maybe 1 day collecting it. And you know, a lot of people just say, just use rebar, you know? And for us, the mentality is what we have to get in. We have to be able to say that maybe there are two options. Like in this example, there's the rebar option. You go to the store, you buy it. It's really cheap. You can even find it in most rubbish bins outside of build projects. But we just don't even like to consider that as an option. We're taking that away. So when we speak about time, the time that we speak about is exactly what it takes. And that's okay. For projects that we work on for other communities or for organizations here in Europe, which is where we've been spending most of our time, we try to very upfront speak about the idea that we don't know how long this will take. We have no idea. For us to do this project, we need to have basically the ability to let the universe and let nature and let this experimentation process dictate the time. It's not us. We are not in control of that. Also, with experimenting with new things, we make our own waterproofing silicone goo, basically. It's not silicon, but you can use it like silicon. Out of beeswax, out of pine resin, and out of charcoal, and you just melt them together. And this takes a long time, too. And we make our own pine tar out of pine roots to preserve rope that we use because we do a lot of thatching. And so this takes a long time as well. And sometimes these things don't work, and we have to modify them. Maybe the pine trees are different than we thought they were. We also use natural materials like this cactus that grows here in Portugal, where we are right now, to ferment it and extract the pectin, which then we can make a plaster, and we can plaster the cob to be waterproof instead of using limestone or concrete. And so all these methods took days and days and days of experimentation to find out what works before we apply it to the building. And we have no idea how long that's going to take. So for us, you just have to stop talking about time, you know? We sort of like have developed a bit of a culture around our build projects in which we have sort of banned certain words from our vocabulary. One of those is perfect, because nothing will ever be perfect in this building. And also one is time. We just try not to talk about it. If people ask how long this will take, we just say, more explain the process and what we think will happen. I want to touch on one of the other points as well, if I can. You talked about how trying to find skilled volunteers is quite hard to build these buildings. And we've found actually just the opposite. I mean, we have had people who've come and helped us for months and they've never built anything before. And maybe their mind isn't even so well developed to think about building. Maybe it's not super logical or super rational. And what we found is that, yeah, man, these buildings are so easy to create. There is such little amount of expertise that has to go into this. Like, maybe a few times when you do a roof, there's a bit of mathematics that we use or a bit of physics. But other than that, once you learn how to make cob, it takes an hour. And then you're a cob master, basically. Or how to put tires together to do an Earthship-style building. Or even how to thatch a roof. This was one of the craziest things. In the UK, this is basically a trade, a skill, with about 150 to 200 vocabulary words developed basically to help thatchers explain to each other in a more direct way how to do thatching. And I taught myself in a matter of about 2 days how to do this. And it was a lot to read through all these old texts that I was finding because we, of course, wanted to do it the more traditional way, which is tarred rope, natural rope, and picking our own canisu. Canisu is the Portuguese word for water reed. So we harvested our own, and it was quite hard to even dissect these texts that were supposed to even help train new thatchers. So it took me about 2 days to learn this, but I was easily able to disseminate that information in about an hour to all the people who were there, and now they're up on the roof thatching. So I think a lot of times professionals sort of maybe try to make their craft a bit more complicated than it really is. Maybe it's an ego thing to build up sort of themselves and feel important that it's a hard thing that they've mastered. From my experience and the experience of people that I've been with, this is not hard. Anyone can do this. And that's one of the most liberating feelings is that, you know, you can be in charge of building your own house and it really doesn't take so much focus. And that's a really beautiful moment that I've seen when people sort of understood that and accepted that, wow, this is actually really possible. And I think that moment comes when people sort of just start doing, you know, stop the thinking, stop the planning, and just start getting their hands dirty.
So you're finding then when you're working with volunteers that because you're doing and learning all of this, that it's easy to get someone up to speed on what they would need to do by being involved in one of your projects.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have people who join us who maybe have had traditional carpentry experience or traditional building experience. Then we get people who join us who just think it's a cool thing and they want to get involved. And both of those kinds of group of people, it doesn't take so long to really get to know this stuff. We were starting this interview project and through talking to a lot of people now who are living in natural houses, what I'm finding is they always have something in common. And I feel this too, and I think other people maybe listening to this show could maybe also agree that using these sort of sustainable skills like making cob or timber framing or cutting wood even, there's something that you're doing that's outside. Maybe you're connecting a bit deeper, maybe with our past generations of humans, or maybe there's something inside of us that just knows how to do these things. And maybe it's our fear of doing it wrong that is what's causing that blockage. And what I've seen is that I just tell people, hey, make some cob, you know? It takes clay, it takes sand, it takes straw, and it takes water. And they just make it. And a lot of times it's pretty well okay because they just feel the materials and they feel that this is what's right. This is the right mixture. And, you know, maybe we have to add a bit more sand or a bit more clay. But overall, people are picking these skills up so quickly, just like we have, you know?
From the way that you've described this, it sounds like yourself and some of the other members of your team are generally overseeing the build project and using the experience that you have as builders to help get them launched and off the ground?
Kind of. With the push tour, we've went to a lot of communities that we've done some small building projects on, and those we've just been kind of working with the community as well. We don't come in as experts because we're not. And then we've also been given a few projects of our own from communities that wanted, like, for instance, we're building a yoga studio here in Portugal. And we're overseeing in the sense that maybe we have a bit more information, but a technique that we use for the push, we use for our build projects, and basically all times when we have humans who get together to accomplish a goal, which is this idea of consensus building decision making. And so an important thing that we tell everyone who comes into the building, just like when we tell everyone who comes into the push, we basically say, this is your project. This is our project. This is no one's project. We are all in this together. And how we reach consensus of what to do next, it comes from that group. So we sit around and we discuss what our ideas are. And maybe people without so much information, maybe they don't speak up so much because they respect the information that's being handed. But many times by adding a new person to this group, the building project that we've done here in Portugal, it's been changed. You know, the original idea that maybe four of us had is not at all what we're doing anymore. And it's basically that way because we are okay at accepting the flow of people and ideas that are coming in. So we have a new person who comes in, for instance, and they have just as much power about what happens in that build project as I do or as my friends do. And so it's a really beautiful way to empower people. You say, you now own this project as well. Do whatever you want to do. And it's really beautiful when people do that. Some amazing things happen.
You're finding that that sense of ownership and that sense of empowerment really helps to move the projects forward in a positive way.
Absolutely. And I think in some sense, these build projects for me and almost everything that we do, it's not just about building the yoga studio as well. What I've learned, I mean, I guess I can just speak for myself, but what I've learned from this way of working with people and focusing to get something done is there comes also this sense of more empowerment. There comes maybe the sense of stripping this idea off that there are bosses, maybe there's people with more control and power who just sort of tell people what to do and then they just do it. So people leave these projects growing as a person as well, positively. And so it's not just even that experience of building a yoga studio that they can walk away saying, oh, okay, yeah, I know how to build cob, I know how to do this. But also they walk away saying, there's another way to organize humans. And of course, we also make really good food, so they probably also really enjoy the food. I think many, many dynamics that are happening in these build projects, it's not at all related to building. When you enter into a consensus building decision-making group, it's a lot for people. And a lot of what we do with that is helping people operate that way. Because if you're so conditioned to basically just be told what to do and do it, when you're now in the position of saying, oh, wow, my opinion matters. And it matters so much that I could stop something from happening if I don't want to have it be done. When you have that sort of control and your ability to express your opinion, it takes a lot from people to even express that opinion. Just that notion of being able to speak up, to fully say what they believe in. We're finding it's quite hard for a lot of people, actually. So also a lot of what we do is help that process become easier for people because the consensus building decision making doesn't work if people don't listen and people don't talk. And we're finding that's actually quite a thing that humans need some healing on.
people listening and people talking, it just gets to the truth of the matter of communicating and being able to have an open, safe place where a dialogue can occur.
Absolutely.
And I imagine that through this process, it's being able to accept, you know, that may not be the way that I personally would like this project to go forward. However, because you have said that, this is important to you. So let's talk about that in a way that isn't angry, that isn't destructive to the project, that still respects the people involved in the conversation. And in the end, whether or not someone, quote unquote, gets their way, there's growth that happens. There's an understanding that occurs that might not normally happen in a more hierarchical system where someone just says yes or no.
Absolutely. And, you know, in situations when, like, we don't use power tools at our build projects. So we all use manual tools. But, you know, one thing that I ask when people come, I say, hey, this is kind of what we like. We don't like to hear the power tools. We like to feel. It's actually quite fun. You can do meditation when you hand drill a hole in a piece of wood. And so we say, please respect that and try it. You know, please respect our desire. Try it. But if you don't like it, I mean, you know, we can be at peace with you using power tools, you know. And some people have used power tools, and that's okay. And that's perfectly fine. Like, that's exactly what this is. Like, you know, it's not some sort of, I have this rigid idea that we have to be fully sustainable with this project and can't use power tools. You know, it's better that it happens as a group consensus that this is what I want to do. I want to not use power tools. But if you still want to use power tools, then use power tools, and that's okay. I found a lot of times too that even when how I think something will happen, when it doesn't happen that way, a lot of times it's better. And I'm really blessed that person had that open space to speak up. And maybe I feel like I'm not getting my way, but the end result is much more beautiful because of what was people involved and what they were doing. So you're exactly right.
Your mention of not using power tools takes me in the direction of wondering about some of the practical pieces of what you're doing and how you're building. In addition to not using power tools, what are the other pieces that go into the way that you build your projects? Like, what materials do you use? You mentioned using the bamboo instead of rebar and that you're thatching a lot. What about things like a metal roof or a slate roof or guttering systems or things like that? Could you walk us through?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't use power tools. And I want to make a quick distinction that the push.org, there's many people on there with their projects using power tools. We don't push any of our ideology of what our definition of sustainable building is on anyone else. That's just how we choose to build. So on the push, there exist projects that they are using metal roofs and they're using power tools. And that's beautiful, too. And they're learning in this way as well. But for us, when we choose to do a building, we choose to use mainly all natural materials. We sometimes use tires, and there's sort of a bit of resistance for using tires with some people. And I respect that, too, because my connection with that material is fully self-imposed. It's this activism inside of me that says, they're dumping them in Africa or in the ocean. Let's take them out of there and let's build houses, you know? And if someone doesn't feel a connection with a tire, we would never impose using that material. And so for us, then you can do thermal mass also with cob. But I think what I'm finding, and my friends are as well, is that the more that we research, the more that we do building, we're not learning about building, but that's what we thought we were. We're learning more just about nature. I'm being amazed with the plants that we can use. Like, we can use beeswax to waterproof something and add flexibility to our resin mixtures. And then this plant here has pectin, which you can ferment for 2 weeks and it can waterproof cob. Like, it's just crazy. It's such a beautiful experience. Many people probably have this with foraging as well, which we do some of. That once you have this lens, once you're given this information, you see the forest in a different way. Now it's not just this thing that you kind of know nothing about. It's like, oh my God, that right there is water reed. We can thatch with that. It grows in water, but it doesn't soak up any of the water. It's waterproof naturally. Oh my gosh, that's cattail. It can cleanse gray water systems. Or that's calendula, and you can eat that flower, and it's really spicy. Like, all these things adds more of a intimate relationship that I experience with nature. And building is one way that I'm developing that with myself. And so when we do building, we of course have, I don't want to call it a rule, We say a lot of things are optionally mandatory, which is not a paradox for us. We're very comfortable with that. But it's optionally mandatory to use natural materials when building. So wherever we do building, we look around and we say, okay, arbitrarily, let's decide about 30 kilometers from this space, which is maybe what we can access with bikes or with low, low, low amounts of fuel or veggie oil, which we use in our car or van. What materials are in this space? And we take that and we just do a survey. We say, okay, in Portugal, there's this stuff called caniche that you can build with. There's wood, but wood is not so prevalent here, so let's try not to use so much wood. There's cob materials. There's this thatching material called kanisu, which is water reed. There's resin from the pine trees that we can tap and use. And if we are looking to nature and we're not finding what we need to succeed the building, we then try to research more. And there's a beautiful databases that, in Europe at least, that the European Union have funded, which show vernacular architecture, when it was done 100, 150, 200 years ago. And that's a great source of inspiration, because then what you could see is how people have been building for most of time of humans. And you can look to see, how are they doing this? Does this help me at all? We also use a website that has a database of biomimicry ideas. So you can search this database by, okay, I need a glue. And then you just basically search the website for glues, and it tells you many different natural ways to make the glue and strength tests of these things. Or then we say, maybe this isn't a need. Is this really a need? If the area around here cannot satisfy this, maybe this is something that this building doesn't need. But we always have a process. And what I'm so happy with is that this yoga studio that we've built now outside Sintra in Portugal at a community is almost, I'd say probably one of the most sustainable buildings in Europe. Almost all the materials, except for the kanisu, was harvested within 30 kilometers. Yeah, everything in there is just natural. And it feels so good to be building with that. And that's what also helps, I think, with having volunteers there, is we're learning these new materials just as they are. Maybe we have a bit more of a context coming into that, that we can maybe learn faster, but we're learning as well, because a building should reflect its exact geographic location. You mentioned slate roofs. This is what they do in the north of Portugal. So they have slate rock roofs. In the south, though, it's kanisu, it's water reed, it's thatching. But we also, down here, because we had access to a few oak trees that were cut down, is we built a roof out of oak shingles, shakes they're called. And so we did that for a roof because we had that access to that material. So we're now not pigeonholed in any sort of model of building. We don't do earth bag building. We don't do straw bale building. We don't do earthship building. We don't do cob building. We don't do any sort of type of building. We just do building. And we let nature and the area around that place, that space that's going to be manifested a building, decide how that building is done.
It's interesting to hear that the more skills you develop, the more materials you get to learn about and interact with, the more options that you have available to you and the less that you have to go down one particular path.
Absolutely. And I think what it also does too is it opens you up to new experiences with your house. Like, I have a girlfriend, amazing one that I've met here in Europe, and she knew nothing about building. And she basically said, wow. She was kind of watching the whole process from afar, you know, getting a little involved here and there. But when the building was done, she said, it's like being surrounded by Pachamama. It's like nature is just all around you. And that is the end result, is that you are just surrounded by nature, which is where most of us get our groundedness from, our center of peace, our center of well-being, our center of fulfillment. And so why not have that in the space that you occupy for a lot of your life?
I'm just taking that thought in. I really appreciate that. And the conversation that I'm having with you today, what I talked with Bob Tice about, that the spaces that we live in, the areas that we inhabit, kind of embody the space that we want to have, that there's a naturalness to it, a softness that reminds us of the further world around us, that they don't exist to separate us from the natural world, but to further integrate us into the place that we come from.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, I think, what was it, Fukuoka said, the goal of agriculture is to cultivate the well-being of humans, and how we do agriculture basically represents our worldview. And I think the same maybe could be said about building. Maybe the buildings that we make also sort of show us our world vision. And like you just said, I think that's perfect. Do they separate us from nature, or do they help us become more connected?
I exist in a stick-built home from the 1970s here in the United States that is many of the things that I look at. If I were to be building a home from scratch, would I do this, something like this? Well, if I had the options, no. But now that I'm here and I've decided to stay in this place, in this space, in this home, what can I do moving forward as I renovate it to make it a more comfortable space to be in and to not necessarily tear down the walls, but how can I then make changes to this space over time so that I am more integrated into the world around me, where there is less separation between the inside and the outside and the natural and the built environment?
Yeah, taps exactly what you just said. What I've seen here in Portugal is that you actually, like I said, these thatch roofs with water reed has been done. That's every house was in Portugal in the south, in the middle, you know, 150 years ago. Now almost none. There's one other thatcher that I know of who's here. But what you see is that there's still this product that they can sell. It's maybe two layers of kinesu, so not very thick, maybe less than an inch, with pieces that are sort of laid next to each other. And it maybe looks a bit like wallpaper, but like an inch thick. And people are putting this on their roof. Now, that's not doing anything functional, right? It's not waterproofing anything. It's like they have a regular roof built on top. It's not insulating like thatch can do. It's not ventilating. It's just aesthetic. People feel like I've lost something with these clay roofs that they have here now. And they bring this back. And you see it all over the place. That and mud plasters and there's just such beautiful ways to make the space that we have more natural, even if maybe the inside of it is not.
I'm just staring at a large expanse of my office wall that is part of the exterior wall, but I have no window there. And I think of what a difference it would be just to put a large, long window down this wall to allow more sunlight in, and how that light could then warm the space on a winter's day because it is south facing.
We might be coming back to the U.S. next year, so maybe we could stop there and help you out a little bit.
Well, it is one of the things that I want to do as we're renovating. I have a block wall that's part of my garage that was never finished by the previous owners, and I want to do an earthen plaster there, both as a workshop and just so that I can experiment with something like that. And that's something that I'd like to do. Well, it's even just as someone who looks to renovate and make changes in their own home, choosing not to use vinyl because it's just it's a bit of an ecological nightmare for the chemicals that are released in the production process, like dioxins and other things. But moving to, if you're not going to use a natural material, looking at, well, what can we recycle? What is reusable? What can be made from post-consumer materials, such as recycled aluminum for siding or steel doors that can later be recycled?
Now, I think like the World Health Organization actually reports that about 30% of all U.S. homes contain enough toxic off-gassing to create this sick building syndrome, which is an environmental illness of the places that we live. So maybe not only are buildings not helping us connect with nature, but they might even slowly be killing us at worst, and at best just sort of making us not have such a high quality of life. So I think there's a lot of really beautiful ways to help fix this, you know?
And I'm reminded of an idea that was presented by Michael Pilarski, in that if we all choose to take care of our little piece of the world, that helps, you know, make the world a better place. And that if we all look to our homes and decide, you know, if I'm going to renovate a home that's already existing, what are some natural products and natural techniques that I can do to not only help encourage that industry, but also to use these products and make my home a better place for me? Or if I'm going to be doing new construction, what are the options that are available? Anyway, you have me thinking down this road because of the work that I'm doing at my house and all the projects that are building up and the different things that we're doing.
And I think the biggest sort of blockage that we're seeing to this movement, to this thousands and thousands and people around the world building these natural houses, is that they're basically illegal. Using these materials and using these methods, most of them are against building and planning permissions. And so it does get quite hard to actually, even if you say, I want to do this, I'm willing to put in the time, it doesn't cost so much money, so you don't have to worry so much about that. I'm willing to start something new, learn these new skills, do this work. There's still that hurdle of the planning and building permissions. It's hard. And anyone who's doing this that you asked now, it's not so easy. They're people finding the legal way are putting together huge documents basically showing that these materials are absolutely okay, absolutely tested in universities, engineering groups, like load-bearing straw bale walls are just as good as timber. Cob is an amazing, amazing thermal mass. You don't need concrete. Things like French drains, you can totally get rid of concrete for the foundations because concrete's about 9% of global CO2 emissions each year. So there's amazing ways to go down the legal way as well. And there's universities providing studies that show these materials are safe, they're 100% practical, that they should be just as widely used as traditional building materials and techniques. And so it's happening, it's changing, but it's slow, just like everything. Change is slow sometimes. And what a lot of people are doing in the light of it being so slow is they're committing civil disobedience, which I think is sometimes a beautiful tool as well, saying, you know, I take the risk. I've seen these buildings before. I know they're safe for me and my family. They are okay. Maybe it's not accepted by society, and maybe it's illegal, and maybe there might be some consequences for this, but that's okay. I'm going to go forward. In the most extreme situations we've seen is houses have been threatened to be bulldozed by local planning permissions. But it always, I can think of at least two examples right now that people got together. They said, this is right. You should not bulldoze this. This is fine. And those houses are still standing today. And this is in Wales, some communities there. So sometimes it's maybe a bit better to ask for forgiveness than beg for permission.
As a member of my local government, I can neither confirm nor deny that perspective. But I do encourage everyone to live the life that they want to, do what they can, how they can, and work with who they need to get these things done. From the conversation that we had setting everything up, I think that I've covered everything that I want to. Our conversation ties in very nicely with some of the other interviews that I'll do, and I'll certainly provide information, links back to those. And I have some other interviews coming up with some natural builders and other folks who are doing this kind of work, so it'll all blend nicely. But before we bring things to a close, Eric, do you have anything else to add to this conversation for the listeners?
I do. I have one thing that I don't think that we touched on so much. It's real quick, but it's just sort of the reason why we do this. Why are we building sustainably? Why are we experimenting with new ways of living? Why are we setting up these communities? Why are we growing food in a food forest instead of monocropping? And I think that's an important question. And I think that deserves a bit of thought. And for me, I understand the reality of all this horrible things that are happening to our planet that's making it maybe not so suitable for humans. But what I think is important, maybe for your listeners to hear, is that I don't think the best place to fix this planet should be from a place of obligation. I don't think that we should feel obligated to go out there and build a natural house because, oh, we've done this and we've done that and we've done this, or we should feel obligated to go plant a food forest because of the food system that's slowly killing our planet as well. I think everything that you should do should be out of a place of love. And I think the best results that you see doing anything in life is going to come from this place, not out of a place of obligation. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that that was said.
No, I appreciate that. Love makes the world go round, and I'm kind of okay with that, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Well, thank you, Eric, for coming and joining with me for this time together to talk about the push.org and the projects that you're working on. I'm really glad to hear that you're really embodying this work as a builder to go out and be building sustainable systems, sustainable homes, developing rules and ideas as you go along, but also honoring people and where they come from and where they're at. That though you can educate and work with others, it's not about inflicting yourself upon them or pushing your ideas upon them. And I like to know that this kind of work is being done and the world is being made a better place because of it.
Yeah, and thank you, Scott. This is a beautiful project you have as well. I think just discussing these things and talking about them is what's going to create change in this planet. And I'm so happy that you have such a beautiful way of doing that. So thank you.
And that was Eric. One of the things that really stood out for me from this conversation was Eric's just do it kind of attitude. We can do these tasks. We can get out there and make things happen. There's no reason to be constrained by our own fears. So let's get out there and do the work and get things moving. As Jack Spirico said, and why I mentioned him in the beginning, is that permaculture is a duocracy. We're tasked to take action, go and plant,
Go and build. Go and make a difference in the world. And along the way, there are people like Eric to show you how to realize your own way forward. If you're interested in natural building or have your own project you are working with, connect to thepush.org and find people you can help and can help you in turn. I'd like to hear from you if there's any way that I can assist you on your own path. Call me, as that's the quickest and easiest way to get in touch, 717-827-6266. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or join in the discussions on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow me on Twitter where I am @permaculturecst. From here, the next episode will be out on Friday, January 31st, and is a shorter Q&A with Wayne Herring. The first show of February, on the 4th, is Natasha Alvarez. We talk about the idea of permaculture as revolution. The week after that is the second part of my conversation with Adam Campbell. Also coming up are the next round of online PDCs I'll be offering later this year. If you're interested, email or call me, and I can share some information with you about those courses and how to register. If you have a project you're working on and would like to sit down and talk with me, I'm open to having that kind of a conversation as well. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it with whoever you want. Just tell them where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.